average winter temperature there is around minus 17 degrees Celsius.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite Biden's promise to end the war in Yemen and his pledge to make the Saudis pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are, he has fallen back into America's hegemonic role in the West Asia region, taking sides, making America a party to conflicts, and selling more weapons. U.S. interest, peace, stability, and human rights be damned. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrea Germanos, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Saudi bombings kill scores of civilians, including children in Yemen. Stay tuned for more. A series of Saudi-led airstrikes were blamed recently for killing scores of people in Yemen as civilians, including children, continue to suffer deadly consequences of the U.S.-backed conflict that has lasted for years. Overnight bombings included one that targeted a prison holding mostly migrants in the northern city of Sa'de. Ahmad Mahat, MSF's or Doctors Without Borders head of the mission in Yemen, said, "It is impossible to know how many people have been killed. It seems to have been a horrific act of violence. A hospital in the city has received 138 wounded and 70 dead and is so overwhelmed that they can't take any more patients," MSF said. Strikes also hit further south in the port city of Hodeidah. According to Agence France-Presse, video footage showed bodies in the rubble and dates survivors after an air attack from the Saudi-led coalition took out a telecommunications hub. Yemen suffered a nationwide internet blackout, a web monitor said. The humanitarian group Save the Children said that at least three children as well as more than 60 adults were reported killed by the series of strikes, though the number of confirmed casualties would likely rise. The children killed as a result of the Hodeidah strike had been playing on a nearby football field, the group said. Gillian Moyes, the group's country director in Yemen, said, "Children are bearing the brunt of this crisis. They are being killed and maimed, watching as their schools and hospitals are being destroyed and denied access to basic life-saving services," she said. "They are asking us, does it matter if I die?" The initial casualties report from Sa'de is horrifying, Moyes added. Migrants seeking better lives for themselves and their families, Yemeni civilians injured by the dozens, is a picture we never hoped to wake up to in Yemen. In the U.S., the Biden administration, like previous administrations, has faced calls to stop supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons and other support being used to wage the bombing campaign on Yemen that's estimated to have killed over 300,000 Yemenis since 2015 and unleashed what the United Nations called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In the New Republic earlier this month, the Queen's Institute's writers wrote, despite Biden's promise to end the war in Yemen and his pledge to make the Saudis pay this price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are, he has fallen back into America's hegemonic role in the West Asia region, taking sides, making America a party to conflicts, and selling more weapons. U.S. interest, peace, stability, and human rights be damned. Responding to the news of the overnight airstrikes, journalist Spencer Ackerman tweeted, America is complicit in this, as it has been complicit in every Saudi or UAE airstrike of this horrific war that Biden and his senior officials once promised to end. I hope they see these children when they sleep at night. The International Committee of the Red Cross sounded alarm about the recent intensification of violence in Yemen. Fabrizio Carboni, ICRC's regional director for the Near and West Asia region, said in a statement recently, "It is essential that we protect the lives of people in armed conflict. The human toll that we witness in Yemen is unacceptable. Civilians living in densely populated areas have been exposed to increased attacks," he continued, causing death and injury and deepening the psychological trauma among the affected communities after 7 years of war. The deadly strikes came after a recent statement from the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, also expressing concern about the uptick in the violence in Yemen. The spokesperson, Ravina Shimdasani, said in recent days there have been dozens of airstrikes and artillery strikes launched by Saudi Arabia and UAE with seemingly little regard to civilians. The fighting has damaged civilian objects and critical infrastructure, including telecommunications towers and water reservoirs, as well as hospitals in Sana'a and Taiz. With front lines shifting rapidly over a large area, civilians are also exposed to the constant threat of landmines, she said. Adding, as has been shown time and time again, there is no military solution to the conflict in Yemen.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a program that aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and provide you with some external perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss why Hindu hardliners want to sideline Mahatma Gandhi, often insulting and questioning his status as the father of nation and his legacy of communal harmony. And we will also take a deep insight into the plight of Rohingya refugees in India. Does the country need a change in its existing law to adjust those fleeing persecution in their country of birth?
Traitor anti-Hindu and pro-Muslim are the words India in general and the world in particular have come across time and time again from the Hindu hardline right against none other than Mahatma Gandhi. Now, they have become vocal enough to use abusive language against him while describing Gandhi's assassin, Natoram Godse, as a patriot. Many right-wing Hindu leaders never mince words when it comes to criticizing Gandhi, but it's backfired this time, triggering outrage and leaving right-wing organizations with umbilical ties to the BJP government embarrassed.
Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, addressed as Mahatma, meaning the revered one, is not only a freedom fighter, but a social and economic revolutionary. His idea of non-violence or passive political resistance against the then colonial rule is praised and followed all over the world. This multicultural, multi-ethnic country became a nation-state owing allegiance to one constitution, one flag, and one government only on August 15, 1947. But India achieving the milestone was never possible without popular movements and sacrifices made by freedom fighters. Gandhi, who actually started his anti-colonial mission in South Africa, became a force to reckon within the early 20th century. His decades-long movement, or Satyagraha, began against the plight of Indian planters and continued until Quit India, a movement in which he gave a call for the British to leave the country. So it seemed to a vast millions of Indians and who saw a father figure in him. But right-wing Hindu elements continue to question the Father of Nation, a title conferred upon Mahatma by the Constitution of Free India. As the new India is emerging, so the rhetoric and derogatory remarks by far-right ideologues, just like the one happened recently when a so-called Hindu monk used abusive remarks against Gandhi and glorified the one who assassinated him in 1948.
Police came into action against Hindu religious leader Kalicharan Maharaj after a video from a religious assembly held in the city of Raipur went viral on social media. He was arrested on the charge of promoting enmity between communities, making derogatory remarks against Gandhi, and praising his assassin during his speech. The opposition is also demanding the arrest of other Hindu leaders for hate speeches. But will Prime Minister Modi succumb to the pressure ahead of the elections in five states?
It seems the biggest issue the right-wing groups commonly called Sangh Parivar has with Gandhi is that he advocated Hindu-Muslim unity. That's against their conception that Muslims and Christians are an internal threat to the nation. But there is another, probably more serious reason, for their hatred of Gandhi is his challenge to those hardliners who had gone on rampaging following the partition of the country in two, Pakistan and India. No wonder that Hindu hardliners and BJP leaders make public statements to build a narrative that blames Gandhi for the country's division and other ills. Still, even though it has been more than seven decades since Gandhi was assassinated, Hindutva forces feel compelled to question his authority. Sadly, the biggest Gandhi-hating segment lies within the Hindus and not outside it, as was seen in a recently held religious assembly. In fact, in today's India, everybody who chooses to abuse Gandhi should have complete freedom of expression since they have the backing of those ruling the country to pursue their Hindu agenda. The hate speeches of Hindu supremacists are actually an apology for not keeping the country intact, and Gandhi is always their convenient villain. But they are unable to accept the fact that no one is safe and nobody would have a future if they are allowed to go unchecked for making inflammatory speeches and creating a divisive environment.
Now to have more insight on the story, we are joined by Mr. Sanjeev Kumar, senior researcher on Gandhian philosophy and peace studies. Mr. Kumar, welcome to the program, sir. Let's begin with your thought on Gandhi's role in establishing a peaceful coexistence and equality in India.
Well, when you try to understand a personality like Gandhi and his contributions, I think it's very difficult, you know, in the sense that if you try to understand his philosophy, often you see there are a lot of contrasting views on Gandhi. In the popular imagination, people have perceived Gandhi's life and journey in so many different ways. He appears to be a Mahatma, great soul, a very ascetic person who inspired a very revolutionary movement in the country. Well, you see in the current discourse also, in the narratives of the discourse today, and of course, during the pre-colonial period, Gandhi was understood, you know, in a very ambivalent manner by people, you know, of course, with people whom he engaged on a day-to-day basis. If you look at the current works of people like Arundhati Roy, they have targeted Gandhi and has, in fact, went on to, brandish him as a kind of a reactionary, scholar who blustered the caste system. Even during his early stays, if you see in South Africa, he is argued that he held a very derogatory views toward the native communities. And now you see all this, ambivalent or I say critical position that people take on Gandhi are by a selective reading of Gandhi, not in terms of making a true assessment of Gandhi in terms of not only the contributions he has made for the country, largely in the subcontinent, but as a global scholar, I think his ideas, are extremely important when we look at the current, crisis we are undergoing today.
Mr. Kumar, Gandhi's critics today have called him a traitor and praised his assassin, who had the same line of criticism. Now, could this be a way of intensifying extremism?
I think so. It is true because in the discussions, earlier, that Gandhi has an idea of accommodative, inclusive idea of India, that of course rested on a very profound idea of religiosity that Gandhi brings in his worldview. When we try to understand other spectrum the ideas of Hindutva, you have to understand it is based on exclusionary criteria, and that is why there are two different views, or you can say two different spectrums through which where we see India of today is heading towards. One is Gandhi's idea of Hinduism, which brings the idea of inclusive accommodative truth, where there is another idea, pitted idea of Hindutva. Of course, it has gained credence today, not to say that it has not gained popularity, but you have to also see that those people who work in the name of Savarkar's Hindutva do try to refer and go back to Gandhi, because there is no alternative to Gandhi, you have to understand. That is why you see, Gandhi is often brought to the public imaginary, even if it is a ritualistic visit to Rajghat or celebrating or bringing certain activities, in the name of Gandhi.
There you have it, Mr. Sanjeev Kumar from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people reacted on social media on the issue.
A cabinet minister of the government of Maharashtra says an insult to Mahatma Gandhi is an insult to our nation. Strict actions should be taken against Kalicharan, and he should be booked for insulting the father of our nation. Indian Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi reacts on his Twitter to an insult to the father of nation by writing Mahatma Gandhi's own words, quote, "You can chain me, torture me, you can destroy this body, but you cannot imprison my thoughts." An Indian activist posts a Gandhi's picture on his Twitter and says Gandhi, wrapped in his white shawl, sits before a microphone to speak at a prayer meeting in Delhi. It was the second day of his fast on January 14, 1948, for communal peace. He ended his fast on January 18th after being given a pledge of harmony by leaders of different communities.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The lack of a domestic refugee protection framework has meant that India's recognition and protection of refugees has been inconsistent and subject to political will and motivation. In the absence of a legal mechanism, the country has seen deviating from its obligations to uphold human rights principle. The reason probably is the religion of Rohingyas. Since the controversial Citizenship Act passed by the Narendra Modi-led government in 2019 provided a pathway to citizenship for persecuted minorities from several neighboring countries, unless they are not Muslims.
Anti-Rohingya sentiment and discrimination seem rampant in India since their arrival to save their lives from a state-sponsored persecution in Myanmar. They not only face deplorable conditions, but are increasingly persecuted for the same reason they were in Myanmar, their religion. That's amid anti-Muslim sentiment in the country that has risen since the right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party under Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power. Over the past few years, the Modi government has introduced controversial policy changes by revoking the semi-autonomous status of the only Muslim-majority state of Kashmir to passing a controversial citizenship law. In due process, Rohingya have become a target as well. Throughout its history, India has accepted refugees fleeing persecution elsewhere, including Tamils, Tibetans, and Afghans. So what has changed now? Of course, there is a change of government with right-wing Hindu groups at the helm. Ironically, Indian rulers cite stateless Rohingya a threat to security, denying them everything they need under international humanitarian laws. Rohingya refugees living in camps in different cities and regions, including Jammu, Hyderabad, Nuh, and the capital New Delhi, many of them believed to be undocumented. Several times, they have witnessed their slums being burnt with media and officials citing unknown reasons. But the reasons are lucid and clear, as they all go in the backdrop of the lack of a domestic refugee protection framework, and refugees, especially Rohingya, are subject to political will and motivation.
The 1951 Refugee Convention clearly states that the asylum state shall not return any refugee to a territory where his life or freedom is endangered due to his race, religion, nationality, or political alignment or opinion. However, India's treatment of Rohingyas has been conspicuously different. In an affidavit filed by the Indian government in the Supreme Court in 2017 on the deportation of Rohingyas, not only called them illegal and infiltrator, but also a threat to security. So the question is, are they really posing a threat to India?
Given that India is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, it maintains that it has no obligation to provide asylum or be bound by the principle. However, as a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it owes obligations to uphold human rights principles nonetheless. In the absence of a legal framework, persons from different countries are treated differently as stipulated in the 2019 controversial legislation of the Modi government. It puts a question mark on a country that wants to get a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Myanmar's leadership took no heed to the international calls to stop the carnage, with the West's own human rights champion Aung San Suu Kyi facing international ire for being a mute spectator. It was a shameful moment for Suu Kyi to face the International Court of Justice last year over a petition launched by the Gambia against Myanmar, accusing it of violating the 1948 Genocide Convention. Will Suu Kyi or any world leaders with sound minds support what happened to an ethnic community in Myanmar? Answer is mixed, seeing the track record of some countries. India falls into this category given its ill treatment of Rohingya. Even India's Supreme Court sided with a government petition to deport dozens of Rohingya under the pretext of a security threat.
Now, to have more insight on the topic, we are joined by Dr. Mohan Zani from London, a human rights activist and co-founder of Free Rohingya Coalition. First of all, glad to have you with us, Dr. Zani. As you know, right-wing leaders refer to the Rohingya Muslims as infiltrators. Do you think this is an effort to identify them as a threat to India's national security?
No, this is not an attempt to identify Rohingyas as a threat to national security of India. This is an attempt to frame the Rohingya as a threat. That's different from, Rohingyas being identified or being a threat to national security of India. India is 1 billion people country with one of the world's largest military and intelligence networks. So the Indian, the Rohingyas who fled genocide in Burma and sought refuge in India, they're less than 20,000. That may even be an overestimation. Mind you, India's particularly the ruling party, BJP, that wants to remake India as, essentially a country of non-Muslims, primarily Hindus and maybe some Buddhists. They have been using this kind of a threat to national security language over the last 5 years. And I was in New Delhi for a security conference, organized by Facebook and one other think tank based in New Delhi. And I share a panel with a BJP member. And also I heard, senior officials from the Indian Home Ministry that basically use what I consider and what many genocide scholars would recognize as the language of genocidal killers, that is, weak and vulnerable the national or ethnic or religious community, is falsely framed as a threat to national security, a threat to the purity of their religion, what they consider their race. And this is the kind of thing that we heard in the Nazi Germany.
Dr. Zani, with India's record of harboring refugees escaping persecution, do you see any difference in how they treat Rohingya refugees and those of other ethnicities?
Yes, absolutely. If you look at how welcoming India has been, since the 1950s towards anti-China Tibetan refugees, right? It's in the interest of India to give home to or refuge to those who are opposed to communist China, and but at the same time, the Rohingya refugees are as I said, just a handful compared to 1 billion total population. It makes absolutely no difference. Whether even if the Rohingya refugees were granted you know, full refugee status with all the legal protections and rights. It would not make any difference in the life of the you know, normal or ordinary Indian, you know, about 1 million. But, you know, mind you, the Modi, the BJP Prime Minister, has brought in a rather, you know, genocidal laws. If you look at what Modi government has done with respect to almost 2 million, you know, Muslims of Assam, you know, some Bangladeshi ancestry, that they have been stripped of, you know, their legal entitlement and rights and protections by the you know, Indian government. The other one is that while the Modi government is treating Muslims in a drastically a nasty way, that it has also opened its door towards an non-Muslim, particularly Buddhist and Hindus from other parts of Southeast Asia, especially Nepal and Bhutan and other places. And so that you can see clearly that India's treatment of Rohingya based on their religion, Islam, is radically different from India's treatment of non-Muslims. And so this is religiously and particularly religiously motivated a policy. If you write policies and adopt policies on the basis of religious background of different populations, you're in the realm of what is considered, genocidal persecution.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Zarni for his precious time and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Founding editor of The Wire, Siddharth, writes on his post that Rohingya in India illegal, a national security threat, the Modi government says, in a court affidavit. The center's affidavit also says that the matter of deportation is best left to the central government's discretion. India's leading newspaper, The Hindu, writes that the plight of tens of thousands of Rohingya Muslims continues in Bangladesh and says 100 babies were born in the no man's land near the border alone. Rick Fuad, attorney and child welfare advocate, says this is the same Aung San Suu Kyi who's mentioned defending genocide against Rohingya. Not that Myanmar junta isn't reprehensible and should be tried at Hague. It's that she should be too. Dr. Fozia Alvi, a physician and human rights advocate, writes on her Twitter that massive fire in Rohingya camps seems that there's no end to their misery.
And that was our episode on Hindu groups insulting India's father of nation, Mahatma Gandhi, and also the Hindu nationalist government's campaign to throw Rohingya refugees out of the country. Thank you for your time, everyone. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the
the limelight.
In Britain, Labour and Liberal Democrats have called for full transparency now that it has emerged Sue Gray's report may just summarise findings. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. The piece is titled PM Facing Calls to Ensure All Evidence is Published in Number 10 Party's Inquiry. Britain Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing calls to ensure all evidence on the Downing Street parties is published with the Sue Gray inquiry. As it emerged, the pivotal report is likely to amount to a concise summary of findings. Labour and the Liberal Democrats called on Friday for the report to be published along with its accompanying evidence, including emails and witness accounts, to give full transparency around more than 15 alleged parties under investigation by Sue Gray, a senior civil servant. The publication is expected to have huge political ramifications, as many Conservative MPs have said they will await its findings before deciding whether to back Boris Johnson to stay on as Prime Minister. If they are unsatisfied, he could face a no-confidence ballot. Government sources said the report was likely to be ready at some point in the middle or end of next week, and Sue Gray could hand it to Number 10 Downing Street. It is understood Boris Johnson will get advance sight of the report, but then he's expected to make it available to the public and Parliament within hours. The terms of reference of the investigation make it clear that findings will be made public. However, The Guardian understands that that does not include accompanying evidence, such as emails, text messages, or transcripts of interviews, or precise details about what happened at any of the alleged gatherings. Government sources pointed to the outcomes of the investigations into Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, and Damien Green, the former Deputy Prime Minister, as examples of how such findings tend to be set out. Both ran to less than 2 pages. The investigation file, including the evidence on which the findings rely, is unlikely ever to be published, the sources said. This may mean an email allegedly sent by a senior official warning Boris Johnson's principal private secretary, Martin Reynolds, not to have drinks in the Number 10 garden on 20th of May 2020 may never be made public. The email is crucial, as Boris Johnson insists he was not warned that bring-your-own-bottle event might be against the rules, and that he was unaware it was a party when he spent about 25 minutes there speaking to staff, believed to number about 30 to 40. The findings will instead be statements of fact about what happened, while leaving the matter of any disciplinary action to the civil service and the Prime Minister. Boris Johnson could decide to refer himself and any other ministers to the Independent Advisor on Ministerial Interests, Lord Gate. Redactions from the findings of the names of junior staff and the potential for any disciplinary action against them are also possible. Angela Rayner, the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, called for a greater degree of transparency around the parties, which have provoked outrage across the country, from members of the public to Tory MPs. Boris Johnson cannot be allowed to cover up or obscure any of the truth when he has insisted on a hugely protracted internal probe to tell him which parties he attended and what happened in his own home. The Sue Gray report must be published in its entirety with all accompanying evidence, Angela Rayner said. Rayner said transparency in government has been eroded under Prime Minister. The Conservatives have shown us how little respect they have for the rules. We've seen private WhatsApp, missing phones, a Freedom of Information clearinghouse, lost minutes of lobbying meetings. Their cover-up culture has lost the trust of the British public. Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, also joined calls for more transparency around the report. Ed Davey said, "Trust is an all-time low, so this report must be open to scrutiny from all those who've lost loved ones and all those who stuck to the rules." Aside from personnel and employment issues, Boris Johnson owes it to the Parliament and above all to the British people to publish this report and the transcripts in full. Anything else will be seen as the usual lies and bending of the rules. Despite the decision not to publish accompanying evidence, several current and former civil servants who know Sue Gray said they believed the report would still be an accurate and potentially damning account of the parties that would not shy away from difficult conclusions. They pointed to the Green investigation, which she led as head of the propriety and ethics team, and resulted in his resignation in 2017. However, other former civil servants highlighted her ability to navigate her way through tricky political problems, which has led to the nickname Sue Gray Area. Gray's investigation has consistently been described as independent, despite her being a senior civil servant reporting to the Prime Minister. Asked whether the probe was independent, Johnson's deputy official spokesman said on Friday, "Yes, it is. It is for that inquiry, that team, to establish the facts. We've said this before. It's an independent investigation team. I think we've set that out from the start." The spokesman was asked what about the inquiry made it independent, and he said, "Well, and we've set out it's being run independently by a civil servant who's been asked to establish the facts." On Friday night, new details emerged about two parties allegedly held at No. 10 Downing Street on 16th of April last year for the departure of James Slack, then Boris Johnson's Director of Communications, and a Downing Street photographer. James Slack has since apologized unreservedly. About 30 people attended both gatherings, with the photographers taking place in the basement of No. 10, while James Slack's colleagues met in the press area. Both groups later met up in the garden, the Daily Telegraph reported. The newspaper was also shown a photograph of revelers in the basement of No. 10 Downing Street, although it is unknown if this or any related text had been seen by Sue Gray. The basement party reportedly went on for at least 7 hours, until 1 a.m., according to the text messages seen by the Telegraph. Wine was spilt on a government printer as music bellowed from a laptop. A takeaway pizza was ordered into No. 10, it is alleged, with slices handed around the garden, while other partygoers took turn on a slide bought for Boris Johnson's infant son, Wilfred.
Economic divide.
The US dollar has remained the world's top currency when it comes to trade, but its standing is increasingly coming under threat. Countries like Iran, China, and Russia are giving it a run for the money. But will they be successful? I know we have covered this topic before, but this edition of Economic Divide will definitely have some surprises for you. Coming up in this program, we will take a look at the Russia-China alliance to dethrone the dollar. It will decrease trade in dollars, and at this point, the dollar use between the two has fallen below 50% in terms of the greenback's bilateral trade value. Next, we will take a look at Iran's push for de-dollarization, a sweeping economic and security partnership deal with China, billions of dollars of Chinese investments in energy and other sectors, and also one with Russia. And finally, we will take a look at the dollar and central banks. The dollar reserve currency is on the decline, as the global reserve currency of central banks in terms of the dollar amount has declined to 59%. That's the lowest level in 25 years. Iran's push to break away from the dollar began a long time ago, but it has gathered steam with the current administration headed by President Ebrahim Raisi. Enhanced cooperation with neighbors has been at the forefront of President Raisi's foreign policy, and that puts the economy at the left, right, and center. His trip to Russia is meant to cement ties. It remains to be seen whether the 20-year agreement between the two countries will be signed or not. This deal covers political, security, military, defense, and economic cooperation. Iran's economy has been picking up steam recently. The value of Iran's non-oil trade with its neighbors stood at $36.8 billion during the first 9 months of 2021. That is a 42% increase year-on-year. So significant that it has placed a strain on Iran's infrastructure, like its transport sector. Iran sees it as a necessity to eliminate the dollar from its bilateral trade with these countries. The current trade with Russia takes place in national currencies. Another example, Turkey. 30 to 40% of trade is also done in national currencies, with the rest in euros. Major export destinations of Iranian non-oil goods were Iraq, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Russia, to name a few. Iran has also laid the groundwork for its other mega deal to take place, namely the 25-year cooperation agreement with China, aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran just announced that its agreement has entered an implementation stage. The agreement was signed last year and includes economic, military, and security cooperation.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year Comprehensive Strategic Cooperation Agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
U.S. sanctions imposed in 2018 bar trade using the dollar system, limiting Iran's ability to conduct imports and exports, slowing its economy further on top of a ban on oil exports. Okay, our social media section is here, and we're going to take a look at how countries like Russia and China and Iran are steering away from the dollar like never before. It's actually a process that has been going on for quite some time. A top advisor looking at this particular tweet of the Russian President Vladimir Putin has made that issue very clear. China and Russia should avoid using U.S. dollars in financial transactions to minimize Washington's ability to bully other countries into following its rules with the threat of sanctions. Danny says the de-dollarization of the world will no longer be a legend or a dream. Soon it will come. Now, he says only the global digital currency is the leader and rulers of the world currency in the real future. Now, speaking of the global digital currency, here we have Russia and China, who are keen to cut the dependence on the U.S. dollar for some time. They are close to establishing what they announced, a new system for direct yuan ruble settlements. This will then help countries like Iran in their push for de-dollarization. But things are moving quickly. First, the Iranian foreign minister visited China to make sure the infrastructure is in place for Iran-China for their 25-year pact, of which they did, and they announced the implementation stage for this.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
And this may explain why Iran's president will be going to Russia to cement the 20-year agreement with Russia. It's a high-level trip in which Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was invited by Vladimir Putin personally to come there. Now, as of the recording of this program, the visit will be taking place, which we will be covering next week. All right, let me introduce our guests for this section. We have the pleasure of having Masoud Barat, joining us here in the studio. Thanks for coming. An international affairs analyst and a sanctions expert. So it's a pleasure to have you. And also we have Dmitry Zolotarev, a journalist and foreign policy analyst. Welcome to you both. Dmitry, I'm going to start with you. We're looking at Iran gearing up to do trade without the dollar. Shouldn't say gearing up. It's doing that. It's already in motion. And you have countries like Turkey, for example, that Iran does trade with, non-dollar trade up to a certain percentage, and establishing this China-Iran strategic partnership deal along with one with Russia. Tell us what you think about that and what additional moves Iran needs to make in order to de-dollarize.
Well, Iran is making right steps and good moves to move away from the dollar. I think, first of all, Iran should build more close economic relations with Russia. Because, I tell you why, because Russia is a good friend, actually, a loyal country to its friends, and always holds to its word. So, which is very important. I'm not talking sentimentally. I'm talking just looking back to Russia's history. This doesn't matter which regime is currently right now in Russia, communist, tsar, or today's political structure. So Russia, I think, is the most reliable economic partner for Iran.
All right. You heard there from Dmitry Zolotarev. Masoud, tell us the relationship between sanctions and de-dollarization.
After the September 11 attacks, the U.S. proceeded to use its economic advantage, especially when it came to its banking sector, thanks to the status of the U.S., dollar being a world reserve currency used in world trade and world banking transactions. It used that to what is called the weaponization of the dollar, and this is what we hear a lot, that the U.S. has weaponized the dollar. And after 2001, when it began using the Patriot Act and began then using the dollar as a weapon, it sent out a message to other world countries such as Russia and China that something is happening. There is a change happening in the way the dollar is used. So they proceeded to devise ways to soften the impact of the dollar used as a weapon. The Islamic Republic of Iran became the target of the cruelest U.S. sanctions. An enormous volume of sanctions were leveled against Iran by weaponizing the dollar, which was unseen in history. Therefore, Iran has a vast amount of experience in being targeted this way. And as such, it can complement other big economies in the world that fall prey to U.S. dollar weaponization.
Very good. Thank you for that. And we're going to come back in our next section in depth to talk this a little further with you. Time now for our InfoNews section of the program. By the way, we had so many suggestions that came from you this past week, so I'd like to take this time to thank you for that. It really helps the flow of the program. Well, first up, the U.S. and its oil reserves. It is diminished by a fifth. That's according to the latest. And this means that the U.S. used, according to the latest reports, 8.4 billion barrels. This was meant to keep the price of petrol low. However, that really didn't pan out the way the U.S. wanted to. It had a friend at OPEC, it thought, Saudi Arabia, but it did not come to its rescue. Additionally, throughout the year 2020, just 3 billion barrels of crude oil reserves were discovered in the U.S., so that's not good news for the U.S. Next up, U.S. inflation. Consumer prices, they have surged by 7% over the past year. Housing and food prices have continued to soar, but something even worse could happen. Prices rising as the economy slows. And that is the textbook definition of stagflation. For a definition check, here is stagflation in case you don't know what it means. We'll be right back. onto the UK economy. UK economy bounced back from COVID shock. At least that's what it was, according to the latest, indicating 0.7% increase. I don't know if you can call it a bounce back, but Omicron has slowed down the economy. After a V-shaped recession, variants impact will put the brakes on, with a double whammy that's due in April. That's what analysts are saying. So the UK economy looks like it's going to slow down based on the latest wave of Omicron, which has hit that country pretty hard. Countries across Europe, actually, are experiencing the same. And then Africa's economy. Growth recorded in the second half of 2021. That's because the vaccines were being available. The vaccine hoarding was done already, making that available. It's really sad at the same time how promising this is, because you had, when the vaccines were available, the growth started to appear, and you had sub-Saharan Africa, for example, recording a growth of 3.5%. Just imagine if the countries that hoarded the vaccine made it available earlier. Okay, that's all for this InfoNews section. The stories were all the ones that you sent to us.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Trade without using the dollar, de-dollarization. Is that even possible? Well, that's a question that has been floating around for a while. I'm sure, or maybe most may have heard about this. But the challenge, the petrodollar system. Now, what is this system? Well, a petrodollar is a U.S. dollar that is received by an oil producer in exchange for oil. Today, all global oil transactions are settled in U.S. dollars. Now, there are advantages to that for the U.S. in many different ways. In essence, it's actually something that the U.S. reaps twice. It receives a double loan out of every global oil transaction. So, first, oil consumers, they're required to purchase oil in U.S. dollars. And then, the second advantage, the excess profits of oil-producing nations are placed in U.S. banks. Basically, these are government debt securities that are held in these banks. Got that? So that's how the U.S. reaps these benefits twice. Now, let's look at China, the world's top oil importer. Well, China is not happy about oil being sold in dollars. It sees it as the only logical that oil should be actually priced in its own currency, the yuan. And what it has done, it wants that currency, the yuan, to be gold-backed. So at least this way, you have something that secures it, because with the dollar, it's not that way. Now, in order for China to reach this goal, it needs to ask other countries to actually trade in oil. So we're looking at how this will involve countries like Iran and even Saudi Arabia. This would create the new petro yuan and then weaken the dollar significantly. Again, these are all under the umbrella of moving away from the dollar or de-dollarization. China sees moving away from the dollar as a necessity and a priority to reduce the dependency on the dollar, and it wants to limit its exposure to U.S. currency risks in order to shield it from U.S. sanctions, which is another reason why it wants to move away from the dollar, along with other countries that it does trade with. Now, if China is successful, the world could end up trading oil primarily through gold-backed currency. Now, isn't that something to look forward to? Well, here you have a question. Could U.S. sanctions and closer West Asia ties fuel the rise of China's petro-yuan? That can happen when China secures long-term energy deals with West Asian nations in order to increase the international use of the currency. And of course, the use of petro-yuan has gained traction as Russia and Iran, which are subject to U.S. sanctions, look to limit the dollar exposure. Let's discuss this a little bit further. Dmitry Zolotarev is a journalist and a foreign policy analyst who rejoins us for this. Dmitry, welcome back. So Russia moving against the dollar, we know that. It has adopted a credit card, actually, in one of its moves, and it also is involved with BRIC countries. You have the fact that Russia has announced a financial payment system with China in which the infrastructure is set in place. Do you think that by Moscow and Beijing joining forces, they will be able to bypass the U.S. dollar